I'll put light to the subject.
Uh-huh.
Okay, now we're set here.
Last week we discussed the conflict between Yaakov and Esau. We pointed out that you find in the Chumash that the conflict was a twofold one. The first thing which Yaakov feared was that his brother Esau was out to kill him. The Torah tells us, Vayisnachem l'chala hergecha, that Esau was trying to do whatever he could to destroy his brother, and therefore he had no choice but to flee, to run away from Eretz Canaan. However, we find later in the parsha a different Esav who approaches Yaakov. Here Esav comes to Yaakov and says, Nisav ne'lecha ve'elcha l'negdecha. He tells him, let us walk together as brothers. And this, we pointed out last week, was a tremendous conflict for Yaakov as well. He wanted, of course, to avoid any struggle, any conflict, any fight with his brother. But at the same time, he wanted to be able to maintain his own identity. He had known all too well what his father Yitzchak had gone through and what he would have to face with Ishmael and the conflict between him and Esau. And the Torah already told us, Shnei Goyim Bevitznech, that this wasn't merely a conflict of two individuals, but rather it was a struggle of nations. So therefore, Yaakov found himself in a most difficult place. On the one hand, he didn't want to wage war against Esav. On the other hand, he knew that he couldn't walk together with him because their life, their ideal, everything that they stood for was in fact so different. Finally, we find in Parshas Vayislach that Yaakov and Esav meet and they're able to go separate ways. And finally, the Torah tells us that Vayavo Yaakov Shalem Yerushchem, that finally we find that Yaakov now is able to return to the land of Israel. He was forced to leave to run away from his brother. He left, and for 20 years he was together with Lavan. He was able to build a Jewish family where all of his children were Jewish and believed in the ideals that he did. Unlike what Yitzhak was faced with, and unlike Avraham, whereas his father and grandfather had many children, some of whom believed in his ideals and some of whom did not, this was not true of Yaakov. And finally, the Torah tells us that Yaakov was able to return to Eretz Canaan, to the land of Israel. Furthermore, the Torah tells us that he returned to the land of Israel, Shalem, complete, whole. And Rashi comments that Shalem is Shalem Bagufa. It meant physically that he was healed from his struggle. Shalem B'mamono, that he returned to the land of Israel wealthy. And Shalem in Hachet, and that Yaakov was able to return as he left. That when he left, he was together with his father Yitzchak. But now so many years passed. 20 years had passed that he was together in the house of Lavan. And yet Yaakov was able to return to Eretz Yisrael, even shalem min hachet, even complete in terms of his religiosity, in terms of his ideals, in terms of his belief. The Medrash asks, what strength was it that Yaakov had that allowed him to return after so many years. And the Medrash tells us what we know early on about Yaakov, that Yaakov was described by the Torah as being the Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. That as Yaakov was growing up, he spent many years of study. He was able to achieve such a strong grounding in Judaism, Jewish ideals, and the study of Torah, that this kept with him even during the many years of exile. Rashi quotes what the Medrash tells us, Im Lavan Garti, that Yaakov says that even though he has lived together with Lavan, Garti lived means V'taryag Mitzvah Shamarti. The word Garti, I have lived with him, Rashi says numerically is the equivalent to the 613 mitzvahs. That even though I spent 20 years outside of the land of Israel, nonetheless, V'lo lamadti mimasav haro'im, I did not pick up any evil traits from Lavan. So it would appear that much of the struggle is over. Yaakov finally is able to return to the land of Israel, and he does so shalem min hachet. He is able to return on that high plateau which he left. He returns with a family. The conflict, at least for the time being, between himself and his brother Esav has now ended. And now it would appear that Yaakov can pursue all of those ideals and dreams that he had when he was young. However, the Torah now tells us in Parshas Vayeshev that another struggle and another further conflict will arise. Throughout the previous parshas, whenever we spoke of a conflict, it was always one of external outside forces. The ability for Yaakov to maintain his identity, living together with Lavan. The ability of Yitzchak to follow in the ways of his father, even though there was another child of Yishmael. Now the Torah tells us of a quite different conflict. It wasn't a conflict of the Torah forces, so to speak, against other influences. It wasn't a conflict between those who were trying to pursue the Birchas Avram, the dreams of Avraham, against those who were not. But rather, now it was a conflict different in nature. It was a conflict among brothers, all of whom were followers of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Now the Torah tells us, even though Yaakov had established all of the Shvatim, all of the tribes of Israel, and now seemingly their position was secure, conflict and struggle would arise even from among themselves, jealousy and hatred among each brother, which the Gemara tells us in Shabbos resulted in the exile from the land of Israel. The Torah describes how it was Yaakov who favored the son of Yosef, that Yosef was the one who was the roe tzon, he was the shepherd. Yosef was the son who was given by his father, aksonis pasim, the coat of many colors. And the Rashbam points out that these two ideas, the notion that he was the one who was the shepherd, and the idea that he was the one who wore that coat, was at that time a position of tremendous prominence. That the brother who excelled, the one who was viewed to be the leader, he was the one who was given the task of being the roe tzon. He was the one who was given the special cloak to wear. And therefore, it was an outward sign which Yaakov had given to his son Yosef, that even though at this point he was the youngest brother, he would be the one who would emerge as the leader. And this caused a tremendous amount of hatred between Yosef and his brothers. In fact, the Gemara tells us in Shabbos and Daf Yud Amud Beis that a person is not allowed to be Mishana Bein Habanim. That it's very important that a parent not show any favoritism at all toward any children. Why? Because the Gemara says, because of the little bit of favoritism that was shown to Yosef above his other brothers, so then Niskalgel Hadavar V'yardu Aboseinu Mitzrayma. As a result of the fact that Yaakov showed favor to his son Yosef, what resulted was that the event started to turn, the ball started rolling, and before you know it, Bnei Yisrael ended up in Mitzrayim. would appear that the Gemara is very critical of the actions of Yaakov. But Yaakov struggled so long to be able to achieve and to be able to be the founder of the nation. And finally he was so successful in doing so. But yet, by showing favoritism toward one against the other, Iskalgel Hadavar V'yardav Oseinu Mitzrayma, what happened was is that the people of Israel were forced to leave the land once again. In fact, Tosfos raises the following question. He is bothered by why is it that the Gemara seems to be so critical of Yaakov, as if to say that Yaakov was to blame for the fact that Bnei Israel had to enter the land of Egypt, leaving the land of Israel. Tosfos asks, didn't we learn earlier in Sefer Bereishis that this was already told to Abraham? God already told Abraham that you will be the father of a great nation. However, va'avadu v'ino osa bar miyoshana. But yet there will be a time that Bnei Yisrael will have to go into galus, into exile. They will go to the land of Egypt, and they will have to be there for a number of years. So why is it, Tosfos asks, that the Gemara seems to be so critical of the behavior of Yaakov, when in fact the subsequent events that occurred seem to already have been predestined? The Torah already tells us that Bnei Yisrael will leave the land of Israel, they will have to go to the land of Egypt, and only afterwards will they be able to receive the Torah at Har Sinai. So Tosfos points out that it's true. There was a decree that for 400 years, Avadu v'ino osa abami oshana, they would be servants. They would not be able to properly inherit their land and receive the Torah. But yet Tosfos writes, there was no decree as to the severity of the slavery during those years. It's true that they would not receive the Torah for some time, and in that sense they would be strangers. They wouldn't yet be able to inherit the land of Israel properly. But yet the servitude that they had to go through in the land of Egypt, that decree was not yet known. And this is how Tosfos explains this question. It's true that there was, in some sense, it was predestined that the people of Israel had to live in the land of Egypt for a number of years. But yet, it was not known that they would be treated so harshly as slaves. And this is what the Gemara, at least to some extent, blames Yaakov for. That because he gave rise to the tremendous amount of tension that existed between Yosef and his brothers, so that meant not only would they be years of exile, but they would be years of very difficult, very trying years of exile and slavery in the land of Egypt. The Ramban Nachmanides writes in Parshas Vayeshev that perhaps if you look at the entire Parsha very carefully, you'll find that all of the events that you find in the Parsha are merely Atzas Hashem Hitakum, merely the fulfillment of a divine decree. The Torah tells us, he writes, that Yaakov told Yosef to go out and to seek his brothers, to see where they were grazing, where he could meet up with them. And the Torah describes how Yosef was trying to find them, and he couldn't. Vayimseihu ish, the Torah tells us, v'hinei toa besode. He was going on his way and he was completely lost. There was no way that he would be able to meet up with his brothers as his father had wanted him to and as he had initially planned. Why is it that the Torah stresses this? The Rashbam and others tell us to show us the commitment which Yosef had to honor the words of his parents, kibbutz, that even though his father told him to find his brothers, and even though he knew that his brothers at this point were very envious of him, nonetheless, he listened to his father and met his brothers. And even though v'hinei toa besada, even though he didn't know exactly where they were, he didn't come back to his father and simply say, I can't find them. But he tried to find their location as best as possible until he found someone, v'yimtzeihu ish, he met up with an individual who was able to show him the way. That's simply what the Rashbam says, why is it that the Torah describes the process of Yosef finding his brothers, to tell us that Yosef was so committed to be able to do anything which his father told him, that he went through all of these difficulties in meeting up with his brother in spite of the fact that he knew that the meeting would be a difficult one and perhaps a very harmful one for him. The Ramban explains, quoting the Medrash Tanchuma. The Medrash says, Vayimtzeihu Ish, that Ish is not to be understood as person, but rather Vayimtzeihu Ish means he met up with the angel, the Malach Gavriel. What is the significance of this phrase of the Medrash? The Ramban says the following. God had already told Avraham, Vavadu v'inu osa abami oshana be'eretz lo lohem, that for 400 years you will be visitors, slaves, strangers in a nation that is not yours. This was the divine decree already told to Avraham. And therefore now the Torah is simply playing out the divine decree that was already given. The Torah is showing us, the Ramban says, that it wasn't because of Yaakov's doing, it wasn't because of Yosef's doing, it wasn't because of something the brothers did alone which caused exile in the land of Egypt, but rather this was part of a divine scheme, a divine plan, because it was necessary, for whatever reason we'll see, that Bnei Yisrael leave the land of Israel and only return years later to receive the Torah. That's why the Ramban says that the Torah tells us, Vayimtzeihu Ish, that he was met by a Malach who led him. What is the Torah underscoring? He writes that had there been no divine intervention, there is no way that Yosef would have ever met his brothers. His father told him to go find them. And the Torah describes how Yosef was journeying and he couldn't find them. He had no idea where they were. So therefore the Torah underscores that under normal conditions, Yosef simply would have had no choice but to return to his father and say, I couldn't find them. And if he never met up with his brothers, all of the series of events which we will read the Shabbos would not have taken place. But yet the Medrash tells us, Vayimtzeihu Ish, means that the Malach Gabriel came and showed him where his brothers were. This is what the Ramban says, quoting the Pasuk of Rabos Machshavos B'Lev Ish, that many times individuals will plan, they have many different intentions, many different ideas as to what the future will bring. However, Vatzas Hashem Yitakum, but ultimately it is the divine decree which prevails. This is the message, he writes, of what you find at the beginning of the parsha, that even though Yosef tried and couldn't find his brothers, there was divine intervention in order to assure that they meet up with each other. And because of that divine intervention, that is what led to the slavery, that is what led to the selling of Yosef, and that is what led to all of the brothers going to Mitzrayim. Because this was part of the divine decree, Atzas Hashem, which said that Bnei Yisrael would have to serve his slaves before they could actually return to the land of Israel and receive the Torah. The Ramban writes that what do we see from this? He writes that ultimately, Hagzeira Emes Vacharitzu Sheker, that divine will, what it is that God sees right for us, ultimately that is going to occur. And whenever a person makes plans, of course a person should do so, but you should always keep in mind that ultimately it is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it is God who will determine, right, how things will transpire, how events will unfold. The Medrash writes, giving a very poignant parable. It says, Mashal Mahadavardome, to what can this be compared? To a person who is taking an animal to slaughter, and the animal doesn't budge. It won't move. So what happens? So how is it that you get the animal to move? So the Medrash answers, Mashcha b'na lefaneha. Take its child and lead the child, which was much easier to lead. And before you know it, the parents will have no choice but to follow. The Medrash says the same is true of Yaakov. Yaakov spent 20 years outside of the land of Israel, and there was no way that he was about to leave again. He always had the dream of his grandfather Abraham and his father Yitzchak to live and to inherit the land. And finally he felt that this was the opportune moment after being away for so many years. But apparently this was not the divine plan. It was necessary that Bnei Yisrael be forged as a nation by going through years of slavery in order to receive the Torah. In order to do that, however, it required that Yaakov had to once again leave the land of Israel. So the Midrash asks, how could that be done? After 20 years away, you're going to tell Yaakov to leave again? He won't go. The only way he went before was because he had no choice. His brother was chasing him, and his mother and his father told him that you have to leave, you have no choice. So here too the Midrash says, this was part of the divine decree, that if Yosef would be sold in Egypt, and if all of the brothers would have to go to Egypt as well in order to get food, then Yaakov would have no choice. Mashcha b'nale faneha, if all the children would leave, then Yaakov would have no choice but to follow. And this was part of Atzas Hashem Hitakum, the unfolding of this divine decree. This is what the Ramban explains later as to why Yosef treated his brothers in such a harsh manner. Sometimes you get the wrong impression that Yosef is being very vindictive. There's no doubt that his brothers wronged him. They were jealous, they were envious, they caused him much pain, and they caused his father a great deal of pain as well. And finally, however, when his brothers appeared to him later, when we'll read in Mitzrayim, it would appear that Yosef is not acting as one who is a tzaddik. He doesn't seem to be acting as Yosef HaTzaddik, the righteous Joseph, but rather he seems to be now meeting out midah keneged midah. The brothers, you were bad to me. You treated me in such a troublesome way. You caused me such great harm. So now I'm the position of authority. I'm the Mishnah of the Melech, the viceroy to Paro. I will do the same to you. The Ramban is very much bothered by this. How is it, why is it that Yosef doesn't reveal himself? Why is it that Yosef treats his brothers as strangers, as if to indicate that he doesn't care about the harm he is causing them? So the Ramban answers along these same lines that he mentions here in Parshas Vayeshev, that Yosef had a dream in the beginning of the Parsha. And the dream said, "Batishtachavena lumasi," that all of the brothers must come and bow before him. So too in the second dream that Yosef had, that all of the brothers are the stars of the sky, and they also will be serving him in some sense. And Yosef saw in this a divine message. For whatever reason, it was necessary that all the brothers, including Binyamin, would have to come to Mitzrayim to see him. And finally, when the brothers meet Yosef and he sees that not all of them are there, he has no choice but to act as a stranger to them. He has no choice but to treat them in such a manner that they will be forced to bring the brother Binyamin with them. Because Yosef realized from the events in this week's Parsha that something out of the ordinary is happening. He knew that it had just been a matter of nature without any divine intervention. He never would have met up with his brothers. He was only able to do so because the Midrash tells us that there was a divine presence, a Malach Gavriel, who came and led the way for him. And therefore Yosef realized that this must be the will of God. What he had dreamed in the beginning of this week's Parshas Vayeshev was not merely a dream, but it was telling us that this is how the bris ben habasarim, the covenant with Avraham, is to be fulfilled. All of the sons, Yaakov the father as well, going to Mitzrayim, beginning a period of exile which ultimately will culminate receiving the Torah and inheriting the land of Israel. The Bar Benel, it's interesting, gives an alternative interpretation. He writes, why is it that Yosef acts in such a strange manner? Why is it that he doesn't show any kindness, any compassion toward his brothers when he eventually meets up with them? Is it really because of revenge, of hatred, of animosity, for what they have done to him at the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev. So the Barbanel writes that just the opposite is true. He writes that if you look in the Gemara in Yuma, and the Rambam mentions this as well in Hilchos Tshuva, in order for a person to truly repent, it is necessary for a person to be in a similar situation and to be able to overcome temptation. Penance, the Rambam writes, means that a person has to have charata, a person has to realize what he did was wrong, and he has to have kabbalah asid. He has to realize in the future that he will no longer do and follow that same practice. What is the test, the Rambam writes? Can a person put himself in a similar situation that he was in the past and not be tempted and not to fall short as he had done previously? So therefore, this is what Yosef's thinking was. The brothers had treated him in a most unkind manner. They were cruel to him, they sold him, and therefore they were deserving of tremendous punishment. It was necessary for them to do tshuva, to do some act of repentance, in order for them to attain kapara, forgiveness from God. And our sages tell us that the best way of doing it is, if you should find yourself in a similar situation, to be able to act so much differently. That's the best manifestation of true tshuva. So therefore, what you see unfolds in the coming parshios, the Barbanel writes, is all of the things that were done to Yosef, Yosef does by posing his brothers against Binyamin. If his brothers would treat Binyamin the same way they treated him, that would be a sign that they haven't really changed. However, if they would be able to stand up and protect and defend Binyamin as they should have protected and defended him, so that would be a real sign of remorse and tshuva, of repentance. And this is in fact what happened. When Yosef finally keeps Binyamin as a hostage, he sees, how is it that the brothers react? Do they react the same way that they treated him in Parshas Vayeshev? Or do they, as we know, act in such a different way to show that they have truly been remorseful and penitent of what they had done in the past? So this is what the Ramban tells us, that you shouldn't think that the Torah is going out of its way at such length in telling us the unfolding of events that really seem to be insignificant. The reason the Torah mentions all these things for us is to show us that this is all part of a divine decree, and it was necessary for everything to happen. It's true that the immediate vehicle which God used was the animosity and the jealousy between Joseph and his brothers, but you shouldn't think that the punishment of exile was a result of that act alone. Ramban says, this is what we believe, Atzas Hashem Hisakum, that ultimately it is the divine decree which prevails. How exactly Yosef got to Mitzrayim is very unclear from the Psukim. The Psukim speak about the brothers doing something to Yosef. They speak about a group of Yishmaelim who come and pass by. Later the Torah speaks about a group of Midyanim who come. And it's very unclear how is it that Yosef eventually ended up in Mitzrayim. Rashi just simply writes the following, that there was a series of sales. First, the brothers were about to kill Yosef. Then they decided not to. Yehuda finally stands up and says, "Ma betza kinaru gesachenu, what good will it do us if we go ahead and we kill our brother? Let us sell him to the caravan of Yishmaelim who are passing by. And therefore, if any blood is spilled, we will not be directly responsible for it." The brothers listen to Yehuda, and Rashi comments that he is sold by the brothers to the Yishmaelim. Then Rashi says, further you find that the Yishma'elim did not actually bring him to Mitzrayim, but the Yishma'elim in turn sold him to another caravan of the Midyanim, a group of merchants. They were the ones who brought him to Mitzrayim, and they were the ones who sold him to Potiphar, where Yosef worked as a servant. So Rashi says, following the Midrashim, following the Gemara, that there was a series of events which resulted in Yosef being found in the land of Egypt. The brothers who sold him to the Ishmaelim, they in turn sold him to Midyanim, and finally the Midyanim sold him to Potiphar, and Yosef rose to greatness as being the assistant to Potiphar. Others disagree that Ben Ezra writes that there is no such chain, that really the brothers sold Yosef to this non-Jewish caravan, and this group of people brought him to Egypt. And interchangeably, the Torah refers to them as Yishma'elim and Midyanim, but they're referring to the same group of people. Yishma'elim because they were from that place, and Midyanim because that is the name that they were known as. But the two different names that the Torah uses are simply referring to the same group of people to whom the brothers sold Yosef and resulted in Yosef going to Egypt to Mitzrayim. It's interesting, the one who has a very novel notion is the Rashbam. He writes in Parshas Vayeshev that the brothers never really sold Yosef. The Torah says that they threw Yosef into a pit. And Yehuda suggested, L'chu v'nim k'renu la'yishmeilim, that let us go ahead and sell him to the Yishmeilim. But it never says that the brothers actually did that. This was just an idea that Yehuda had. Don't bother killing him. Right? That will be too much of a tragedy, too much of a sin on our hands. Why don't we go ahead and sell him? And as the brothers were deliberating, another caravan of people came, the Midyanim, and took Yosef to Mitzrayim. When the brothers finally returned to the pit where they had left Yosef, the Rashbam says he was nowhere to be found. But he points out that the Torah never mentions explicitly that the brothers actually sold him. The Torah seems to say it was the Yishma'elim who sold him to the Midyanim. And whereas Rashi creates a chain that one sold to the Yishma'elim, who in turn sold to Midyanim, who in turn went to Mitzrayim, Rashbam says the brothers were guilty. They didn't save Yosef. They didn't do what they could to try to bring him back to his father. But if you look in the Torah, he writes, you will not find that they actually sold their brother Yosef. They weren't sure what to do. And as they were sitting and deliberating, another group of people came and took him away. Yehuda's suggestion was certainly to sell him. Yehuda says, Mabetza kinaro gesachenu, what gain will there be for us if we go ahead and we kill him? It'll be a sin for which it will be so difficult for us to retain any form of tshuva. It'll be such a terrible act. V'chuv nimkrenu Yishma'elim, let us go ahead and sell him. And the Torah says that the brothers listened to Yehuda. Yehuda was in a very powerful position. He would be one of the most powerful of the tribes. And the brothers listened. They didn't put Yosef to death, but rather either they sold him or they didn't kill him, and subsequently he was sold by another group of people. And therefore the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Avav is very critical of the statement of Yehuda. Yehuda was in a position of authority. Apparently, his brothers were willing to listen to him. And yet, Yehuda did not say, we have no choice but to return Yosef to his father. Yehuda said, let's not kill him. Let's merely sell him. Let's simply, v'nimkarenu, v'nishma'elim, let us sell him. If he wasn't in a position of power, the Gemara says, the brothers would not have listened to him. But yet Yehuda saw that he had their ear, that they were going to listen to his suggestion. But yet, he didn't suggest that they bring him back and don't touch him. The Gemara discusses this in an interesting context. The Gemara speaks about pshara. When it comes to dinim amanos, when it comes to monetary cases of civil law, is it better to give a psak din, to give a concrete response, to say that this person is guilty, this person is innocent, this person is obligated to pay this other person a certain amount of money? Or the Gemara says, is it better to try to get a pshara, to arbitrate and to try to come to a certain compromise? The Gemara quotes three views regarding this question. One view says that pshara is forbidden. If a person goes to a court of law, it's not the job of the court to try to maintain peace and harmony, but the court has to enforce the law. They have to say this person is guilty, this person is innocent. We don't assume the sway of the halacha. We assume mitzvah livtzoa, that if possible, the best thing to do is to be able to reach a compromise in court, to satisfy all parties involved, that no one should go out victorious and have the other person go out being in a state of despair, being angry. If somehow we can satisfy everyone, if it's possible, we try to do so. Mitzvah livtzoa. It's good, if possible, to reach some kind of compromise. However, the Gemara says, when it comes to areas of compromise, a person has to be very careful. The Gemara says, if you look in Tehillim, in Perek Yud, you find the pasuk of Botzeya Birech Nietz Hashem. But sometimes if a person compromises in an improper fashion, Nietz Hashem, it's as if the person is cursing God. Whenever a person puts himself in a situation of compromise, a person has to make sure that he is arbitrating the law in a proper fashion and not distorting it. And the Gemara cites this parsha as being one of the cases of incorrect pshara, incorrect suggestion. The Gemara says that Yehuda was in a position to be able to convince the brothers not to harm Yosef. But yet he didn't do so. He stopped short of what he should have done. True, he said not to kill him. And true, they listened to him. But he didn't go far enough. He said, L'chu v'nim perenu Yishmaelim, let us go and sell him. And that is in fact what the brothers did. So the Gemara says, this is an example of compromise which is not warranted, which is improper. Right? The Gemara says the same phrase is used in that pasuk as with Yehuda. Yehuda says, Ma betza kinaro gesachenu. What will we gain, ma betza? The Gemara says, Botzeya birech, whoever praises the one who was Botzeya, who used that term, what will we gain? Nietz Hashem. He's cursing God. Because if a person is really in a position to be able to make certain changes, and the person doesn't do so, what he tries to do, whether it's in religious life or in other cases, is to work out some kind of compromise, then a person has to be very careful to make sure that the compromise is one which the Torah recognizes as being valid. If Yehuda had no choice, if Yehuda felt that the brothers wouldn't listen to him, had he suggested to them to bring Yosef back, and he had no choice, the only thing he could do was to try to plea bargain them to sell him as opposed to kill him, then it would have been a proper compromise. Then Yehuda could be praised. But the Gemara tells us that because of Yehuda's strength, because of the position which he was in, he could have accomplished much more. And sometimes a person has to be very careful. If a person is weak, sometimes you have to settle for a compromise. Sometimes people don't realize their own strength. They can be in a position really to be able to enforce the law properly, as the Gemara says in Sanhedrin. And instead of doing so, they try to rely on pshara, on compromise. And this, the Gemara is very critical of Yehuda, because Yehuda could have saved his brother. And instead, because of the actions of Yehuda, it resulted in his being sold as a slave. That's clear, that's...
Where were the other brothers? Where was their Yosef?
It's very true that the other brothers felt helpless, either because they didn't know any better, or because they felt they couldn't stand up to their older brothers. If Reuven was unsuccessful, and Reuven was the Bechor, he couldn't persuade his brothers. And Yehuda was the strongest of the brothers, and he wasn't successful. Either for better or for worse, the other brothers felt that they had no choice but to comply. And the brothers are punished for it. No one is saying that the brothers acted in a proper way. The Gemara says that this was a terrible act of sinas chinam, of hatred, and it resulted in galus. It resulted in exile. There's no doubt that they were very far from being perfect. What is unique about Yaakov is that the brothers were able to do tshuva, and the brothers returned and they formed the ancestry of the Jewish nation. That's not true of Esau, that's not true of Yishmael. They went their own way and continued to go so. And therefore, their descendants are not Jewish. The descendants of the Shvatim certainly are. But it's very true, the Gemara says in Shabbos, in Daf Yud, the Gemara is very critical about their behavior. The Gemara says, finally, that Yaakov was at a position, that he was in the land of Israel, and everything that occurred now should have been only the tov, it should have only been for good. But yet, they had to face this inner strife that they had, an internal conflict, which was unprecedented. The conflicts that we found before were always nations, the nation of Yaakov versus the nation of Esau. But you don't find the sinas chinam, the hatred animosity that you have between the brothers. And that was something that was very severe. Right, and that was something that the brothers certainly are punished for.
So who is held more responsible? Is it that Yaakov is more responsible for showing the favoritism in the first place, or is it as a consequence of the sons' reactions among themselves?
It's a good question. When the Gemara mentions in Shabbos and Daf Yud, the Gemara seems to single out Yaakov. That Yaakov was the one who allowed this to happen. Sometimes, you know, a person should realize that if you have many children, or if you have many students, if you have many individuals, and you don't treat them fairly, that you show favoritism toward one, it's only natural to assume that animosity will arise. And therefore, since Yaakov was the one who did this, Yaakov didn't do it in order to create animosity, that was for sure. But the Gemara says that Yaakov should have had the foresight to do so. And as a result of what he did, then you can't blame him for everything, but he did serve in an immediate sense as being the catalyst. It is true. The Gemara just mentioned that Yaakov was, so to speak, the first cause. Had it not been that, apparently there were other things that would have triggered it off. The Torah in the very beginning of Parshas Vayeshev goes out of its way to tell us that Yaakov seems to be acting in an unusual manner toward his brothers. He is being motzi dibara, he's reporting to his father what the brothers are doing. He's acting in a way that he goes to them and he is revealing his dreams to them. And normally you don't find that. Normally you find throughout the Torah that when a Navi is given a nevuah, even if a person believes that he has prophecy, the person is not supposed to reveal it. He's not supposed to go around telling everybody that he has attained Nevuah, that he is a prophet. The only time he's allowed to do so is if God commands him to go in to tell this to the people. Then you're obligated to do so. So it's clear that Yosef was somewhat at fault as well. But apparently what the Gemara says very poignantly is that the brothers could have handled that. But if you have a series of brothers, and one brother or one sister starts acting out of line, it doesn't have that much effect on the rest of the family unless that their action is supported and reinforced by the parents as well. That if Yaakov would have turned around and told Yosef, what you're doing is improper, Right? If you have a dream, so the dreamer should be kept to yourself. You shouldn't go around telling, after all, you're the youngest brother, that you are the greatest, that you're the one who's going to emerge as being the leader, and all the others are just going to be stars that are going to bow down to you, and everything will revolve around you. That, apparently, the Gemara says, should have been the response. But given that difficult situation, when Yaakov, instead of responding that way, reinforced what seemed to be the inequality that Yosef was leading, then that's what the Gemara says, broke the camel's back. Then that straw, right, was what told the brothers that they had no other choice but to somehow do something in order to stop the situation. He was certainly the youngest of the brothers, and the Torah doesn't give us an exact age at that point, but he was quite young when this happened. Yeah, he was in his teens. He was quite young. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Earlier, you mentioned in the Gemara it says that you could have stopped the brothers. It seems to me, though, reading it, I have the impression that, there's this kind of mob psychology that takes over, and nobody can stop what's happening. Partly because there's so many who are all part of it.
It's true. Often that's the case. And it's difficult for us to know without any tradition, looking in to see what the situation was. What was clear is that Reuven did not agree. And the Gemara seems to feel that if Reuven, together with Yehuda, would have been able to stand up as one, they would have been able to stand up to the other brothers. That there were certain brothers that were naturally in a position of leadership. And sometimes when things go wrong, that they seem to be the first ones who are to blame. Not only because that they contributed, but because even more than that, that they didn't use their leadership ability to be able to do what was right. And the Gemara says that we see just from the phraseology of the pasuk, "Mabetza ki narog es achenu," that this is something later which Yehuda is criticized for. That sometimes a person has to be able to stand up and say what he believes in, even if it goes against what the majority are saying. And even if it risks, as you picture, that maybe the brothers would have turned around and said, that's not true, and they wouldn't have listened at all. But that type of compromise, to sell a brother into slavery, it's better than killing him. But certainly it's not something to brag about or be proud of. The Gemara says that Yehuda could have accomplished much more. The brothers, it would appear, were not sure what to do. It wasn't that they were an angry mob and all they wanted to do was destroy their brother. They were human. They were faced with a brother who was acting improperly. They were faced with a brother who was being motzi dibara. They were faced with a brother who was acting in a haughty way, and apparently he had the haskama, he had the recognition of his father as well. And they felt something had to be done. But you see from the Torah that they didn't want to kill him, even though that was their initial response. That they never went through with. They just somehow wanted to be able to teach him a lesson. And Yehuda could have suggested a much more appropriate way. We'll see later on in Parshas Bereishis that Yehuda ultimately redeems himself. That the same Yehuda who suggested the Chuvanim Krenel Yishmaelim, who started the whole chain, ultimately it's going to be Vayigash Elav Yehuda. It's going to be the same Yehuda who uses that leadership power to save Binyamin. And this is what the Ramban and the Barbanel write, that you find a tremendous parallel between everything that was done to Yosef and things that were not done, things that should have been done, but somehow the brothers didn't live up to those expectations. But when it came to Binyamin, then each one of the brothers was able to fill and turn around that shortcoming that they had expressed and demonstrated earlier. That the same Yehuda who suggested a compromise did not bargain with Yosef. When Yosef started bargaining and says, let's leave some brothers here, let's leave Binyamin here, and all the rest of you go back, so now Yehuda says, there's no room for a compromise. Vayigash elav Yehuda, Yehuda says, I am taking a firm stand, and there's no way that we will leave, right, with leaving Binyamin here. And at that point, the Torah says that Yosef breaks down, Yosef reveals himself, and sends for his father, Yaakov, to come. What was that significance? That Barbanel points out that Yosef was just waiting for that last piece to fit into the puzzle. The last piece was for Yehuda to act in a way that he failed to do in the past. In the past, he didn't act as a strong spokesman. He didn't act as the person who saved Yosef. So Yosef said, if somehow we can get Yehuda to be pushed into a corner that he'll act in that way, so then we'll be able to redeem what seemed to be a fault in this week's parasha as well. And you see it. You see Yehuda took a stand, and not only did the brothers follow, but even Yosef followed. And if he can take a stand against Yosef, at that time not knowing who he is, being the viceroy in Egypt, he could have taken a stand as well against his brothers. Yeah?
Without thinking of your kids, of course, if the destiny was there, it had to which other people would it have taken?
It's a very good question. There's always, as the Rambam points out, there's so many things that are predestined in the Torah. The Torah says that there is going to be an exile. There's going to be redemption. So this is what the Ramban tells us. You can't really blame Yosef. You can't blame what he did at the beginning of the Parsha. You can't really blame the favoritism of Yaakov. Because favoritism is not good. To be haughty and to brag about a dream is not good. But it doesn't seem to be the type of crime that would warrant such a serious punishment of years of exile in Egypt. What the Gemara does say is we have the following principle, that Magalgalin Chov al Gabi Chayev, right, discuss Ayadei Zakai, that sometimes good events, even though they may have been predestined, are brought about by other good actions, and guilt or punishment can be meted out because of guilty or improper behavior. The Gemara says, for example, that Hilchos Shabbos were given in the Torah. But there was one person who didn't listen, the Makosha Sheitzim. He went out on Shabbos, and he was gathering wood. So the Gemara says that that's an example of Megalgalin Chol Al Yedei Chayev. That it was because of this individual who did such a bad thing, that's where the Torah chose to tell us about the severe punishments of Shabbos. Or the Gemara tells us that the daughters of Tzlachvad were Nashim Tikkanios. They were very righteous women. And therefore, because of their act and because of their request, that's why that the whole parsha of Yerusha, of inheritance, is given as a result of their inquiry. Because of this notion of Magalgalin Schus Ayidei Zakai V'chol Ayidei Chayim. Similarly, you find here, it's no doubt that there was, to some extent, right, a predestined decree that Bnei Yisrael would be in Mitzrayim. Tosus, as I mentioned earlier, writes, it didn't have to be as severe as it was. For after all, the period was 400 years. When did the 400 years begin? It wasn't 400 years of slavery. That was a much shorter time. It was only half that period. Most of the time was not actual slavery. So Tosus writes, had the Avos and had the children of Yaakov acted in a perfectly proper way, the 400 years could have been less harsh than they were. That's what Tosus writes, the degree of severity. Just like, for example, other Rishonim write when it comes to punishing Paro. How can Paro be punished for something which was part of a divine decree, a divine plan? So similarly, as Tosus points out, the severity, the way that he treated the people of Israel, Avodas Parech, so that was something that was his doing. That was not necessarily part of a covenant with Avraham. That's what Tosus writes. Ramban says even more than that. That if you look carefully in the Parsha, you find an unfolding of divine will. Not only in this Parsha, but in all the Parshios that deal with the children of Yaakov in Mitzrayim. He points out there had to be a catalyst. Things don't happen in a vacuum. The catalyst was the sinas chinam, hatred, animosity within a family. Why does the Torah do that? To tell you that important lesson. As the Gemara says, that al yishana adam ben min abanav, you can't single out a child. If you single out a child, he is the favorite, and ignore the others, this is what will result. A person always has to act in a perfectly moral way, strive to do so. And therefore, the Torah says that in some sense, this behavior of Yaakov served as just the first peg the first step in what was niskalgal hadvarim. The language the Gemara uses is niskalgal. Niskalgal means things started to turn. Yaakov didn't cause Bnei Yisrael to leave and to be in Mitzrayim. He did everything to make sure that they would stay in Eretz Canaan. However, niskalgal hadvarim means that the wheels already started turning. A process started to begin. And the process was one that ultimately resulted there. So this is the message that you find in Parshas Vayeshev. Somehow we're faced with many conflicts. We have a conflict between us and other nations of the world. That conflict somehow Yaakov was able to overcome. He had a confrontation in Parshas Vayishlach, and yet, Vayavo Yaakov Shalem Yerushchem, he was able to return to Eretz Yisrael Shalem, complete, in spite of that conflict. However, what almost broke apart the family was the inner conflict, a conflict of brothers. That struggle sometimes is much more intense, much more profound. Somehow the conflict with strangers, with Esau, that Yaakov felt was difficult, but he was able to deal with it. Because Shnei Goyim Bevitznei, he realized that this isn't a brother, this is a different nation. However, when brothers among themselves begin quarreling, then the Gemara says, what happens is niskalgal hadvarim. Then it is true, as we see ultimately, it's possible to get back together. It's possible to emerge again as one nation. It's possible that the experience of Yetzias Mitzrayim will result in a stronger nation of Israel, a nation that will now be ready to receive the Torah as they weren't yet in previous generations. But what is clear is that the tension and the struggle is so difficult, often it's much more painful than an external struggle. This is the beginning message that you find in Parshas Vayeshev. We'll see in the weeks to come, how is it that everything unfolds? How is it that the brothers that seem to be so full of hatred and so separate will unite as one and finally be able to be the nation of Bnei Yisrael to which Yaakov can be proud.
Did you go over any? Oh, you went one tape. Was it all right? I think you recognized
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
so,
very good.
Did you, so, well, this is a good.
Yeah, it really works well. We began discussing last week some of the halachos that pertain to Chanukah, and specifically the mitzvah of candle lighting of Hadlakas Ner Chanukah. The Gemara tells us in Shabbos and Daf Chaf Aleph that there are three different levels of fulfilling the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah. The first is Ner Yishu Beiso, that a person is obligated to have one candle per night, per household. And that, technically speaking, is the extent of what the Gemara calls the Ikar HaMitzvah, the minimum amount of candle lighting that is required during Chanukah. The second level, which the Gemara mentions, is called Mahadrin, an enhanced form of fulfilling the mitzvah, which means that everyone should light Ner Lechol Echad B'Echad. But if you have five people in your house, then each night of Chanukah, five candles should be lit. Then the Gemara has third level, which is called Mahadrin Min HaMahadrin, the most enhanced form of fulfilling this mitzvah of candle lighting, which means that you should light the number of candles corresponding to the day of Hanukkah. One candle for the first day, two candles for the second day, three candles for the third day. There is, however, a difference of opinion as to exactly what this means. What is meant by Mahadrin Min HaMahadrin? So Tosus writes the following. What this means for us is that you just have one menorah per household. On the first day you light one candle, the second day you light two candles, the third three, and so on. It is not based on the middle stage. The middle stage was that each one has to light. And this is the Sephardic practice, based on what Tosus writes, that only one menorah is lit per household. Because Tosus writes very simply that if everyone in the house is going to light, then you're not going to be lighting corresponding to the day of Hanukkah. On any given day, you can have 20 candles in the house, and you don't know why you have 20 candles. There could be four people lighting, and it's the fifth day. It could be five people lighting, it's the fourth day. It won't be clear from the amount of candles that you have which day of Hanukkah it is. So therefore, Tosus writes, and this is what the Mechaber writes in the Shulchan Aruch, the Sephardic practice of lighting one menorah. The Rama writes, and this is the Ashkenazic practice, that this is not true. That Mahadrin, Min HaMahadrin means that everyone in the house should light their own menorah. Not to have one menorah per household, but everyone should light their own menorah. So therefore, if you have four people in the house, four people should light one candle the first day, two candles the second day, three candles the third day, and this is what we assume is the ideal practice. Minimally, it's enough just to have one candle per night, but maximally that everyone should light their own menorah. The Gemara says that this mitzvah of candle lighting not only applies to men, but it applies to women as well. And this is one of the three places in the Talmud that you find the principle of Av Hein Hayu Ba'oso Hanes. And therefore, they are obligated in this particular commandment. That normally speaking, Mishnah tells us in Kedushin Adav Chavtes that women are exempt from any mitzvah sasesha hazman grama, any positive commandment which is bound by time. So therefore, women are exempt from the mitzvah of sukkah, women are exempt from the mitzvah of shofar, women are exempt from the mitzvah of Luluv and Esro. Tosus points out that that doesn't mean they shouldn't fulfill these mitzvahs. They should be encouraged to fulfill the mitzvah because they fulfill a mitzvah by doing so, and they should recite a bracha when they do so. But there is no obligation. It is not an imperative. However, the Gemara says that there are three exceptions to this principle based on the idea of Av Hein Hayu Ba'oso Hanes, that every because they were also included in the mitzvah of Purim. The Gemara says in Pesachim Adav Kuvches that the same thing applies to Dalad Kosos, drinking the four cups of wine on Pesach. Why? Because that commemorates Yetzias Mitzrayim, redemption from Egypt, and Av Hein Hayu Ba'oso Hanes. Women were certainly included on that. because they were also included in the mitzvah of Purim. The Gemara says in Pesachim Adav Kuvches that the same thing applies to Dalar Kosos, drinking the four cups of wine on Pesach. Why? Because that commemorates Yetzias Mitzrayim, redemption from Egypt, and Afen Ha'avos Sahanes. Women were certainly included on that. Rashbam writes that that really means women not were simply included, but women were responsible for the redemption, and therefore women are obligated to perform the mitzvah of drinking four cups of wine. And the Gemara has this when it comes to Ner Chanukah, that the mitzvah of the Ner Chanukah is something, the miracle corresponds to men and women alike. Everyone was included in the miracle, right? The winning of the battle, the miracle of the oil which burned for 8 days, and therefore women are obligated as well in the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah. So the Gemara says women are obligated in the mitzvah, and therefore women should light an Ner Chanukah as well. There is a practice which is common, this is what the Mishnah Berurah mentions and others, that if, for example, the husband lights, so many women do not light. Many times the wife does not light a separate menorah. This is a prevalent minhag, a prevalent custom, but many disagree. Rav Soloveitchik always assumed that the Gemara says women are obligated in the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, and we assume in Shulchan Aruch that means that everyone should light their own menorah. So he felt that the preferred practice is that women light a separate menorah. But there are others that disagree, the Chafetz Chaim, who says no, that the wife can be included in the candle lighting of her husband, and some women rely on this. They don't light an independent menorah, but rather they rely on that. What is the best time to light Ner Chanukah? So the Gemara says in Shabbos and Daf Chaf Aleph Mitzvaso that the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah is Mishetishke hachama ad shetichla rego min hashuk. The mitzvah begins tishke hachama. That means either at sunset or at nightfall. The Rambam writes that it means sunset, and therefore one should light candles, the Rambam says, at sunset. The Mordechai, which is quoted in Shulchan Aruch, says that no, that person should light the candles not at sunset, but rather at nightfall, when it gets dark outside, after sunset. And these are various customs as to when is the ideal time of lighting the candles. There are those who follow the view of the Rambam and they light at sunset, and there are those that wait until nightfall. After it gets dark, a half hour after sunset, maybe even longer, that's when many have a practice of lighting candles. The Rambam writes, however, one should be careful not to light candles before sunset, because the Rambam writes that if you light candles before sunset, then you don't fulfill the mitzvah. The earliest time you can light is at sunset. Right? In this respect, the Rambam writes that lighting Ner Chanukah is different from lighting Shabbos candles. Shabbos candles, you have a right to light early, but the Rambam says this is not true of Ner Chanukah. The earliest time that you can light the Ner Chanukah is at sunset. So one certainly should not light before sunset. After sunset, one may light. Until when can a person light? So the Gemara says the following. The mitzvah of Ner Chanukah is Mishatishka Hachama. It begins, again, either at sunset or at nightfall, and it extends Ad Shetichlo Regel Min Hashuk, which literally means as long as people are no longer found on the streets. Why does the Gemara give such a time period? Because Tosus points out simply that the purpose of lighting the candles of Chanukah is to achieve Pirsume Nisa, to be able to publicize the miracle. By lighting candles, we're demonstrating to others. We're not simply doing it privately. We're demonstrating to others the miracle of Chanukah. That's why the Gemara points out that in the time of the Gemara, it was necessary to light the candles not in the house, but to light the candles immediately outside the door, into the public street, that everybody should see that you are lighting the candles. And in Shulchan Aruch it says if a person lives in an attic, a person lives on a second floor, a third floor, a fourth floor, a person should try to light near a window, that people can perceive of the Ner Chanukah which is being lit. Because this is the purpose of the Neros, Pirsume Nisa. In fact, it is a discussion which is found in Shulchan Aruch. What happens if a person lights in a certain manner that no one else will see it other than him? There is no real Prasumenisa. The only person who's going to derive any benefit or see his candles being lit is he himself and no one else. So it's a question of Shulchan Aruch whether a person makes a bracha, right, on that candle lighting. When he lights, and no one else is going to be there in order to witness, in order to be able to experience the enjoyment of seeing his Ner Chanukah. Right? Different opinions are quoted in Shulchan Aruch. A person should certainly light. Just a question whether a bracha should be recited. There are those that say a bracha should not be recited, and others disagree and assume that you can, if you light in such a way that no one else will see it but you. But ideally what it says in Shulchan Aruch is you should try to get other people to come in to see the candles burning. Because that is the purpose of the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah. So that's why the Gemara says, how long does the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah extend? Mishatishka hachama, from nightfall or sunset, until tichla regam and hashuk, until people are no longer found on the streets. Because if people are no longer outside, then it means there is no one outside who will be able to perceive of your Ner Chanukah, which is lit. So the Rambam writes that in his time, this was approximately a half an hour. The Rambam says, Kechati Shah. It was about a half hour. They didn't have electricity. And when it used to get dark, people used to hurry home. And therefore, the Rambam says that within a half hour, no one was found in the streets anymore. Used to go to bed at nightfall and used to get up at the crack of dawn. So that's where this half hour notion comes from. You see printed sometimes that a Chanukah has to burn for half an hour. Because of what the Rambam writes, that in his time, after a half hour, people no longer found in the streets. Rav Soloveitchik always points out that for us, Tichla Rega Min Ashuk is much, much longer. The Gemara doesn't say it has to burn an hour, a half hour, 2 hours. The Gemara says the purpose of Ner Chanukah is that people should be able to enjoy it. And as long as there are people who are around can enjoy it, you should have a candle which is burning. So if you're lighting at 4 o'clock, Rav Soloveitchik always used to say, and you're going to be up for several hours, it's best if you can to have candles burning for several hours, that the entire time that you're up, you'll be able to see the Ner Chanukah burning. Not that it should only burn for a very short period of time. That's where Rav Soloveitchik himself always uses Shabbos candles every night of Chanukah. Not only right on the Shabbos Chanukah, but every night of Chanukah. In order that, as long as he's up, you should be able to perceive of the beauty of the mitzvah. This is something which preferably many assume the halacha. But the Gemara doesn't mention a particular time period. So minimally, that all you need is a short period of time, no doubt. But the best thing to do, the Gemara says, is to have it burning as long as people can appreciate it. So therefore, for us who light in the house, so therefore, as long as we're up, if there's some way to extend the mitzvah, so it's a more beautiful way of fulfilling it. So the Gemara says, what is the significance of the statement? The mitzvah of Ner Chanukah begins at sunset until Tichla Rega Min Hashuk. So one view in the Gemara is the Ilo Adlik Madlik. That means that the only time you can light the Ner Chanukah is during that period. From sunset until the time that people are no longer found in the streets. Let's say in the Rambam's time, he says it was a half hour. That means you only have a half hour to light candles. If you wait, let's say you come home at 7 o'clock at night, the Rambam writes, you can no longer fulfill the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah because people are no longer found in the streets. Tosfos points out that today for us, this doesn't apply. It certainly doesn't apply because if people are still out there who can appreciate it, right, so then as long as people are there, you can light. But furthermore, Tosfos says that our practice, generally speaking, is to not to light outside, but we light in the house. The Gemara describes the following situation, that really, technically speaking, the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah is to light outside. Tefach ha-samuch l'pesach, to have a menorah placed outside your door. But the Gemara says there was a shas ha-sakana. There was a time of persecution where the Jews, and possibly even others as well, were not allowed to have religious lights, right, burning, symbolizing a particular holiday. And therefore, the Jews were not allowed to have their candles lit outside. So the Gemara says, what do you do in such a situation? So, shas ha-sakana, you can't light outside. So then the Gemara says, minicha agabe shofano v'dayo. So light in the house, and finished. And this has been the prevalent practice. There are still those who light outside. But the prevalent practice is everyone lights inside the house. Because the Gemara says that if the time of Sakana where lighting outside isn't feasible, it's not practical, it's not possible. So therefore, you can fulfill the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah by lighting inside. So Tosis points out, now everything changes. If you're lighting inside the house, so then we're saying that the Pirsumei Nisa, the manner in which we are publicizing and appreciating the mitzvah of Chanukah, is not for those who are outside. The people who are outside really are not the ones who are seeing our Ner Chanukah, which is being lit. The real Pirsumei Nisa, publicizing the fact that now it's Chanukah, is for those who are in the house. So Tosis points out, if a person gets home late, so as long as there are people still up in the house, there's no problem with lighting late. But even though the Gemara says one should not light late, so that's because the Pirsumei Nisa was outwardly directed for people outside. And in certain places, after 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, people are no longer found in the streets. So therefore, you can't light. But Tosfos says, we who light inside the house, our Pirsumei Nisa is geared by the people of the household. So as long as people are up, right, you should light, even if it's very, very late, any time before sunrise, Tosfos says. You can light the Ner Chanukah, and if people are up, right, that's sufficient. And that is called Pirsumei Nisa. So ideally, as with every mitzvah, a person should try to fulfill the mitzvah as soon as possible. So if sunset now is 4:30, so if possible to light at 4:30 or 5 o'clock, either at sunset or at nightfall, that's the ideal way of fulfilling the mitzvah, the first opportunity possible. But if you're not going to be home until much later, so then you can light when you get home, as long as it's at an hour that people are still there to appreciate and be able to witness the Ner Chanukah. One thing the Gemara does mention, and this is the Gemara in Sukkah Daf Lamed Ches, that whenever a person has upon himself an obligation of fulfilling a mitzvah, he should refrain from doing anything else. The Gemara says, for example, there's a mitzvah of Lulav and Esrog. So let's say I don't have a Lulav and Esrog. So nothing I can do. I don't have one, so I can eat my festive meal for Sukkah. So I'm sitting in the Sukkah, enjoying my meal, and all of a sudden someone brings the Lulav and Esrog. So the Gemara says, Yitlenu afilo agabi shachana. Don't finish your meal. Stop where you are and pick up a Lulav and Esrog. So here the Gemara says a very important principle, that even though a person may have an awful lot of time to fulfill the mitzvah, right now I'm having lunch, it's 12 o'clock, and I can pick up a Lulav and Esrog at any point in the day. The Lulav and Esrog is for the entire day. Nonetheless, I have a mitzvah which I'm obligated to perform. So a person should not engage in anything else until he fulfills the mitzvah. So therefore, the Gemara says that this is normally true. That a person, let's say, when he gets home, the first thing he should do is daven. Daven Maariv, you come home from work. If you have a minyan that you always go to and the minyan meets at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, so then you can always daven at the minyan. But if a person normally doesn't daven at a particular set time with the minyan, so the Gemara says the first thing to do is always to daven. You have a mitzvah before you, and before you do anything else, before you sit down to have dinner, so daven. Unless the Gemara says that you're eating at a time that you can't daven. Let's say during the summer it doesn't get dark until 8:30, 9 o'clock. You don't have to wait until 9:30 to have dinner. Right, if you're sitting down and it's not the time to do a mitzvah, so you're allowed to do whatever you want. But once it's the time to do a mitzvah, so that's what the Gemara says in Sukkah, a person should do that first. And we discussed this several weeks ago regarding Havdalah. That why is it that a person is not supposed to eat or do any malacha, do any activity before Havdalah? So one of the reasons is not because Shabbos is not yet over. Maybe Shabbos is over as soon as it's nightfall. But still you're not supposed to eat. When a person davens, or a person says, Hamavdu ben kodesh l'chol, that means the Shabbos is over. But still you're not supposed to engage in other activities, because right now you have a mitzvah of Havdalah. And until you fulfill the mitzvah, a person shouldn't start doing other things. So that's what's quoted in Shulchan Aruch. That as long as people are up, you can light the Ner Chanukah, even through the night, even until the crack of dawn. Preferably, all things being equal, the best thing to do is to light, right, at the beginning of the time. But one should refrain from doing anything extraneous during the time of the mitzvah before one has really fulfilled the obligation of Ner Chanukah. That's ideally what the Gemara says. So the mitzvah begins either at sunset, at nightfall, and extends for us as long as people are there to perceive of the candle being lit. The Gemara says that there are several brachos that you recite when you light the Ner Chanukah. The first bracha is simply, Lahadlik Ner Shel Chanukah. There is a mitzvah of hadlaka, to light the Ner Chanukah, and that is an inherent part of the mitzvah. Right? Only a person who's obligated can light a Ner Chanukah. A woman can light a Ner Chanukah. A man can light a Ner Chanukah. If a child lights a Ner Chanukah, that's no good. It may be good for himself, for the obligation of chinuch, training him to fulfill a mitzvah, but it's not considered to be a proper Ner Chanukah that others can fulfill the mitzvah. So before a person lights the Ner Chanukah, they make a bracha of Lahadlik Ner Shel Chanukah. Then the Gemara says there are another two brachas. There is a bracha of She'asah Nisim and the bracha of She'ahyanu. This is a bit unclear from the Gemara as to why these brachas are recited. Because here you can explain it in one of two possible ways. One way is that the bracha of She'asah Nisim and the bracha of She'ahyanu are attached to the mitzvah of lighting the candles. Whenever a person fulfills a mitzvah that's infrequent, we're obligated to make a bracha of She'ahyanu. You hear Ki HaShofar, it's rarely done. You make a bracha of She'ahyanu. When a person picks up a lulav and esrog, you make a bracha of She'ahyanu. When you sit in the sukkah, you make a bracha of She'ahyanu. A mitzvah, the asim yizman lizman ve'enu tadira, a mitzvah that is infrequent, that requires a She'ahyanu. So perhaps that's why you recite a bracha of She'ahyanu. But perhaps you could argue that there's more to it than that. That the bracha of She'asah Nisim and the bracha of She'ahyanu are not to be associated, or perhaps not only associated with the mitzvah of lighting candles, but rather they are associated with the status of the festival of Chanukah itself. On every yontif, we always make a bracha of She'ahyanu. Not because of the mitzvah. We make Kiddush on yontif, and you make a She'ahyanu. She'ahyanu is not going on Kiddush. Kiddush is a mitzvah you fulfill every week. When a woman lights candles and she recites a bracha of She'ahyanu, the She'ahyanu is not on the candle lighting. The She'ahyanu is on the sanctity of the yontif. Even if you don't make Kiddush, you still make She'ahyanu. As he pointed out, that's what we do on Yom Kippur. You can't make Kiddush, the Gemara says, an Erev and a Daf Mem. You can't drink any wine. So you go to Shul and you recite a bracha of She'ahyanu. Because She'ahyanu is appropriate even on the sanctity of the day. So this is an interesting debate that you have among the early commentators of the Gemara as to what is the function of She'asah Nisim and She'ahyanu. Are these brachos to be associated with the mitzvah of candlelighting? Or are these brachos to be associated with the sanctity of the day? The festival of Chanukah requires a bracha. Let's say you have someone who is homeless and who is not lighting a candle for Chanukah. Can they make a bracha of She'asah Nisim or She'ahyanu? Because even though they don't light candles, they're still experiencing the festival of Chanukah. So this is questionable. In fact, there is a question as to when you recite these brachas. Everyone agrees that the first bracha of Lahadlik Ner Shel Chanukah is directly associated with the lighting. So therefore, it is to be recited over La'asiyasan, before you light, then you make a bracha. That's always what we do. There is the Bahag's opinion that when you light Shabbos candles, as we mentioned, you can't do that. Because once you make a bracha and you declare it Shabbos, you can't light the candle anymore. So the Bahag says that Shabbos is one of the few exceptions that first you do the mitzvah and then you make the bracha. And the Rama writes in Shulchan Aruch, quoting the view of the Maharil, that's the custom of women covering their eyes when they light candles. That even though they light before the bracha, they don't derive any benefit from the candles until after the bracha is recited. When it comes to Ner Chanukah, so then you always make the bracha first. But what about the bracha of She'asanisim and Shechiyanu? That's unclear. So the way it says in Shulchan Aruch is all three brachos should be recited first and then light the candle. Because all three brachos are to be associated with the mitzvah of candle lighting, and all three brachos should be recited first. And that is the general custom. Recite all three brachos the first night, recite two brachos the second night, and then light the candles. There are other sources that disagree. And they assume, as I mentioned, that the She'asanisim and Shechiyanu are applicable to the sanctity of the day of Hanukkah, and therefore make the bracha of Lahadlik. Then, you just made a bracha of Lahadlik, now light the candle. After you light the candle, then make a bracha of She'asanisim and Shechiyanu. This is what the Maseches Sofrim says, and this is what few people do. But the prevalent practice is to follow the strict halacha as is quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, and that is to make all three brachos and then go ahead and light the Ner Chanukah. Okay, that is what we do. It's important also to recite the paragraph of Haneros Halalu, right, which is printed in the Sidurim. That's found in the Maseches Sofrim. That's actually found in Brisos, in Mishnayos, in the Talmud. Most Surahs are custom. But to say the Haneros Halalu beforehand, so that is something which you'll find in the Sidurim, and that is actually mentioned in the Gemara, that we are now lighting candles, and we're doing so for a purpose. So there is this paragraph which is mentioned in the Gemara that tells us the purpose of our lighting the candles, and therefore this should be recited. And afterwards there is a custom of singing Maos Tzur, but the real halacha is to say Haneros Halalu beforehand. It's a general question that the Gemara asks in Shabbos Naf Chav Gimel, that how can you ever make a bracha on Mitzvahs Derabanan? How can you ever say Mitzivanu on Chanukah or on Purim? That's what the Gemara asks. V'heichan Sivanu. Where is there a mitzvah? Because these are only rabbinic obligations. We do it when it comes to Hallel, we do it when it comes to picking up a lulav and esrog, the rest of the days of the festival. The first day it's a din d'oraisa, but the rest of the days it's only an obligation to Rabbanan. So the Gemara answers that no, that built into the Torah is an authority that the Chachamim have to create dinim d'Rabbanan, and therefore we have a right to say v'tzivanu. The Gemara asks, v'heichan tzivanu, where, how can we say you commanded us? Where did you command us? So the first thing the Gemara says from Lo Sasser. Lo Sasser min hadavar shem l'chalaminu smo. Don't deviate from the words of the Chachamim left or right. Part of that ability, that authority that the Chachamim have, is to create a takana institution such as Chanukah and Purim. So that's what the Gemara tells us. But it's a din d'Rabbanan, an obligation d'Rabbanan to light. So that certainly is the Birchas HaMitzvah, and that should be done before. And most common practice is that all three brachas are recited beforehand. It's very important to underscore, as I mentioned, when it comes to Havakas Ner Shabbos, that the Gemara says in Shabbos, and it's quoted in Shulchan Aruch and in Simitav Reish Ayin Gimel, and it's quoted in Reish Samach Gimel and Hilchos Shabbos as well, that you have to light in your house. It's true of Ner Chanukah as well. That the only place that you can fulfill the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah is at home. If you're going away, let's say you're going to be away for Shabbos, so for that Shabbos, that is considered to be your home. And therefore, we generally assume the halacha that you can certainly even light your own menorah in that particular house. But let's say, for example, you're elsewhere, you're at someone else's house, and you see it's getting late, right? It's time to light. Lighting in someone else's house is not an option. Just like it's not really an option for Ner Shabbos as well. So therefore, let's say you're having dinner elsewhere, you can't light at that place. But you have to wait till you come home and to light at home. Similarly, that's what you find in Shulchan Aruch as well. There is a custom that a shul should have a menorah. Right? And therefore, during the days of Chanukah, it's customary that in the synagogue light a menorah. But it's clear in Shulchan Aruch that you can't fulfill your obligation with that. Even the person who lights in the synagogue, he's lighting because there's a minhag, there's a practice to do so. But not because with that he's fulfilling the mitzvah. Because the mitzvah can only be fulfilled in a person's house. That's why, in fact, Tosfos writes, why is it Tosfos says that we have a bracha of Shias Anisim? The bracha of Shias Anisim, Tosfos says, not only applies to a person who lights, but even if a person doesn't light, if a person doesn't have a home, but he sees an Ner Chanukah. So the Gemara says he can't make a bracha of Lahadlik, because after all, he's not lighting an Ner Chanukah. But he can make a bracha of Shias Anisim, and he can make a bracha of Shachianu. So Tosfos writes, why is it, in one view, that there's a special bracha on making a bracha when you see an Ner Chanukah? The Gemara says, if you light an Ner Chanukah, you make three brachas the first night. Haroa and Mevarech Shtayim. If you don't light, you just see candles that are burning, you can make two brachas. So Tosfos asks, why is it that you have a bracha for Haroa, a person who sees it? Because Tosfos writes that there are some people that don't have a home, and they can't properly fulfill the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, but in order to be included in the festival of Chanukah, a special bracha was instituted on a person who doesn't light himself, but who sees that there is an Ner Chanukah which is lit. Right, so then that would be a question, whether you actually can make a bracha. The simple reading of the Gemara is that you can't make a bracha of Shias Anisim and Shachianu. There is one view, this is what the Miri writes in Daf Chav Gimel, and the Miri writes this also in Megillah and Daf Dalet, that you can. That, let's say a person doesn't light and doesn't see. Right? He doesn't light, and he's in a place where no one lights, so he doesn't see anything. So the Meiri goes as far as to say, and some assume this way, lahalach as well, that you can still make a bracha of Shias Anisim and Shachianu. Because the bracha of Shias Anisim and Shachianu has its place on the sanctity of the day of Chanukah. Even without lighting, and even without seeing. The simple reading of the Gemara is not that way. The simple reading of the Gemara is, it has to somehow be associated with the Neros of Chanukah. If you light, then you can recite it. If you don't light, but you observe it, so you're part of the Persumenisa, you're part of the fulfillment of the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, and therefore you can make a bracha. But there is one view that some do rely on the halacha as well, that even if a person doesn't light, or even if a person doesn't see any candles that are lit, you can still make a bracha of Shias Anisim and a bracha of Shachianu. Okay, but this is important to underscore, that the candles, right, should be, right, in such a fashion that you're lighting in your house, right, because that's where the Gemara says the mitzvah has to take place. Yeah?
Why does the rabbi make it like it's so important? I mean, it's integrated in the mitzvah themselves, so why simply make it like it's in the
Torah? That's very clear that... That's true. It's very true that there certainly is a difference between a mitzvah min HaTorah and a mitzvah d'Rabbanan. A mitzvah min HaTorah means something that's found explicitly in the Torah. A mitzvah d'Rabbanan means that that is not so. But nonetheless, the Torah gives the authority to the Chachamim to institute these halachos for... Because there's more than just... Correct, but nonetheless, there are certain requirements. What makes it a candle lighting of Chanukah as opposed to anything else? It's not enough just to remember that it's Chanukah. And any way that a person does it, right, that's sufficient. If you remember it by lighting a candle, that's good. If you remember it by putting up a sign, Happy Chanukah, that's sufficient as well. What's kept us together is that there is universal experience of fulfilling mitzvahs. That there is a notion that everyone is to fulfill mitzvahs in the same fashion. And the Gemara tells us that you shouldn't think that the Chachamim can get up and do whatever they want. If you look in the Torah, you'll find very carefully rules and regulations about what types of institutions the Chachamim should do and what types of institutions they can't. And based on this, the Gemara coins the following phrase, that called the Tikkun D'Rabbanan Kein D'Oraisa Tikkun. Whatever the Chachamim establish has to be in some sense based on something that you find in the Torah. They can't just get up in a vacuum and tell you to do this. They have to base it on an existing halakhic principle that exists. What about Ner Chanukah? What is that based on? So Rashi writes, and the Ran writes, and the Ravid writes, it's based on the mitzvah of lighting candles in the Beis HaMikdash. That the Torah tells you how to light candles, and the Torah tells you a very elaborate process of how candles are lit in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash. And that's what we commemorate, that in the Beis HaMikdash, They only had enough shemen for one day, and it burned for 8 days. And we commemorate this by lighting the candles. So therefore, the Gemara says, we do so by lighting in our homes the same way that they used to light in the Beis HaMikdash. So it's true, the obligation to light in your home is not found in the Torah explicitly. But the declaration that the Chaim declared is not merely to do whatever you want to remember. To do that same action in our homes that was done in the Beis HaMikdash, and that has very rigid requirements. Because the spirit of the law is very important, but only if it's accompanied with observance of a strict letter of the law as well. This is true of rabbinic precepts also. So this is what we have when it comes to Ner Chanukah. Where is it that one should place the menorah of Ner Chanukah? So, it's found in Shulchan Aruch the following, that a person shouldn't place it too close to the floor. Because if it's right on the floor, then it's not really perceivable as being a proper Ner Chanukah. So the it's not called a kosher candlelighter. Because a kosher candlelight has to be in the house, and it has to be on a proper menorah. It's very important to do that. But when Lubavitch and other groups, for example, erect a very large menorah, they're not doing it because this is how they have to fulfill their mitzvah. They're doing it that the public should be aware to create a certain level of Jewish consciousness that this is the holiday of Chanukah. That's a very important task, but it shouldn't be confused with the real fulfillment of the mitzvah. There are a lot of other halachos that we still have to get to about Chanukah. We'll do this next time. And these are the halachos aside from candle lighting. The halacha of reciting Hallel, and Al Hanisim in Berachas HaMazon, and tfilos that are specially said on Chanukah. So next time we'll just conclude with the halacha, halachas ner Chanukah, and then continue with these elements as well.
Oh.